Welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dial, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to break down what I'm thinking about, and we are going to talk about what I'm reading about. And today we have a gem. You see, once again, this podcast was already in the hopper. I had already recorded it. I was ready to go. And then Dr. John Mandrola sent out a tweet, and it sent me down a rabbit hole that I could not escape from. And it leaves me, yes, me, asking you, the listener, one simple question, and that is, what do the Senate Finance Ethics Committee, Big Pharma with deep pockets, and mafia-like arrangements, as well as patients with a 40% increased risk of ischemic myocardial events, all have in common? Well, I will let you ponder that, because without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back, Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's do this thing, shall we? And in the opening credits, I told you that today's podcast was inspired by a tweet. Yes, a tweet from Dr. John Mandrola. And he said in this tweet, and I quote, "I am embarrassed to have not really known the details of Rosie Glitazone affair. Teaching this to learners has to be tenfold more valuable than the Krebs cycle. My gosh, talk about lessons learned. We have to promote more skeptical priors." With this tweet, he attached a link to a paper titled "The Rise and Fall of Rosie Glitazone." This was a 2010 publication in the European Heart Journal. And I will tell you, John, if you are listening, have no fear. I also will say I did not know the details of the Rosie Glitazone affair, but after spending the last 3 days digging through this paper and the sources to this paper and the sources to those papers and the sources to those papers, by the end of this podcast, you will know exactly what I found, and you will know exactly what a finance ethics committee, big pharma with deep pockets, mafia-like arrangements, and a patient that has an 40% increased risk of ischemic myocardial events all have in common. This paper, and ultimately, hopefully, this podcast, is a wonderful summary about rosiglitazone and the scandal of the mafia-like drug company hiding and covering up the evidence related to cardiac events. For those of you that do not know, or those of you that are not medically related, rosiglitazone is a diabetic drug. It is part of the glipizide family, and although rarely seen on medication lists this day and age, the story behind this drug is a tragic and sickening story for a drug that was once the largest selling diabetes drug in the world. Yes, you heard me correct. The largest selling diabetes drug in the world. In 2006, sales of rosiglitazone reached over 3 billion, yes with a B, not with an M, billion dollars. And ironically, 3 billion will come up again later in this podcast, so keep that in mind. In order to really know the whole story behind rosiglitazone, I feel like we kind of need to start towards the end. And towards the end was in 2007, when the New England Journal of Medicine published a paper titled "Effect of Rosiglitazone on the Risk of Myocardial Infarction and Death from Cardiovascular Causes," which was a meta-analysis that sought to find if cardiovascular morbidity and mortality were decreased by rosiglitazone. Ultimately, their results showed that those in the rosiglitazone group compared to those in the control group were 43% more likely to suffer a myocardial infarction, and a trend towards increased rates of death from cardiovascular causes. Although not statistically significant, the odds ratio was 1.6, and the 95% confidence interval barely crossed 1 at 0.98, but the upper end of the 95% confidence interval was 2.74. I mean, it is really showing that there is a signal towards increased death, which would make sense, because you were 40% more likely to have a heart attack. And we know that when you have a heart attack, that typically leads to poor long-term prognosis compared to those individuals that don't have a heart attack. But results like that are a show stopper, a show drug prescription stopper. You have the top drug on the market for diabetes, bringing over $3 billion. And then, bam, we find out that it's actually causing heart attacks and maybe death. Of course, GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of the drug, came out and said, no, it is one trial and our drug is just as safe as any other diabetic drug. In fact, during this entire course of events that does transpire, GlaxoSmithKline has never come out and said that they did anything wrong. At best, at one point, they said, well, I think we could have handled it differently. But as you will see as we go on through their story, I think we all agree, not only could they have handled it differently, but they should have handled it differently. And now that we know the end of the story, or what tends to be close to the end of the story, let's go back to the beginning. The whole story starts out back in 1998, when troglodytazone was the only glitazone on the market. Unfortunately, troglodytazone was associated with rare but potentially fatal hepatotoxicity, also known as fulminant hepatitis. This was obviously a bad thing, and the FDA, as well as type 2 diabetics everywhere, as well as physicians, wanted a better option. And here you have rosiglitazone. To save the day, in steps in rosiglitazone, a drug that was approved by the FDA after just 5 trials. And those 5 trials consist of under 3,000 patients. Because it's only 5 trials, I think that we should go through each one just briefly so you realize the depth of knowledge, the whole plethora of information we had before the FDA approved this drug. And this information is widely available. The information that they gave the FDA is widely available. So here are the 5 trials. There were 2 studies that were placebo-controlled trials that lasted 26 weeks. There was 1 study that was a double-blind comparison between rosiglitazone with glipizide compared to just glipizide alone that lasted 52 weeks. There was 1 study that was a 26-week study looking at the effects of rosiglitazone or placebo added to metformin. And last but not least of the 5 trials, it was a 26-week double-blind study comparing metformin monotherapy versus rosiglitazone monotherapy versus rosiglitazone plus metformin. There you have it, the 5 trials that got rosiglitazone FDA approval, just under 3,000 patients and a grand total of 3 total years of data, with the longest trial being 52 weeks and the 4 other trials only lasting 26 weeks. There are so many problems in these trials, but let's just cover a few of them to make sure that we're all on the same page before going forward. You see, one of the problems is the duration of the trials. A 1,000,001-week-long trial is not the same as 1 trial that lasts 1,000,000 weeks long. They're just not equal. The hard outcomes need time to develop. As football is back this weekend, it's like a good play-action pass. It just takes time for the play to develop. And the same can be said for the hard outcomes like death, heart attack, and stroke, which often take a little bit of time to develop, and these short trials often miss these outcomes. And it's really easy to miss these outcomes when your trial isn't powered to look for these outcomes, because all of these trials were looking for a change in the A1C or a change in the fasting blood sugar. In an effort to try to stay on topic, I won't go on too much of a rant, but there is a huge problem with the A1C and the fasting blood sugar. But the main one is the lack of association with A1C and the hard endpoints. High A1C is bad. I will grant you that. An A1C of 13, 14, 15, really super high, is a really bad thing. And that seems pretty clear. But as long as you are somewhat controlled, the macrovascular complications don't really appear to change very much, or your risk to the macrovascular complications do not appear to change very much. And to approve a diabetes drug based on glycemic effects is just not smart. Who cares if a drug lowers your blood sugar? Who cares if a drug lowers your A1C if it makes you 50% more likely to have a heart attack? It makes you more likely to die. Who cares what your blood sugar is when you're in a casket? Yet we as the medical community are all obsessed with the A1C and trying to trend it and track it and feed it. And there are metrics that we are provided that we have to hit to get this A1C because it's some sort of patient-oriented outcome that doesn't really matter. And that is no more clearly seen than in the story of rosiglitazone. And for those of you out there that don't believe me, and for those of you out there that say, you don't know what you're talking about, the current all-star drug in diabetes is the SGLT2 inhibitor, which is showing benefits for cardiovascular outcomes. However, when you go look at the tables, when you go look at the patients that are on any of these SGLT2 inhibitors, the change in the A1C is very little and usually not even statistically significant. A1C seems to be a surrogate marker that we put way too much strength in when there is likely something else that is going on that is still unclear. The one thing that is very clear is that A1C does not tell us the whole picture. But enough with my rant, let's get back to rosiglitazone. Of the five trials that were used to approve this drug, you will find that if you dig a little deeper into the numbers, in three of the five trials, the LDL cholesterol was increased on average by almost 20%. Plus, there is also a significant amount of weight gain that was associated with rosiglitazone. In the six-month trial, those randomized to rosiglitazone gained almost 10 pounds more than those that were randomized to the control group. Saying that differently, 20% of the patients randomized to rosiglitazone had gained 5 to 10% body weight at 6 months, compared to only 2% of the people that were randomized to placebo and only 1% of the people that were randomized to metformin. But just maybe, the biggest problem of all when you really dig in to the five trials is that when you combine all five trials, the rates of ischemic cardiovascular events were almost twice as common in those individuals randomized to rosiglitazone compared to those individuals randomized to the control arm. But good news. Remember how I said that troglodytazone was associated with fulminant hepatitis, this very severe liver toxicity that could kill you? Well, it looks like rosiglitazone did not share this trait. In all five very short trials, there were no, zero, zippo, zilch cases reported of fulminant hepatitis. This is a win, right? This is great news. And remember, the FDA and patients and doctors and everyone, they want a different option. They want a better option. They want one that doesn't have this risk of liver toxicity. So here you have a drug that doesn't give you liver toxicity. And when you scroll down to page 40 and 41 of the medical officer review of the new drug at the time, the new drug for rosiglitazone, you will read, and I quote right from the paper, "Due to atherosclerosis is a major cause of morbidity and mortality in patients with type 2 diabetes, and it cannot be assumed that treatment with rosiglitazone will decrease the risk." This medical officer goes on to say, "My concern about the deleterious long-term effects on the heart should be addressed by requiring a sponsor to provide adequate information in the label about changes in weight and lipids. A post-marketing study to address these issues needs to be a condition of approval." I'm going to read you that last line again because that is a key line in the overall story of rosiglitazone. "A post-marketing study to address these issues needs to be a condition of approval." And with this very simple 40-plus page document, there you have it. May 1999, FDA approval for rosiglitazone. And there are two big things that happened right around this time. The FDA approved rosiglitazone, and Dr. John Buse, a diabetic specialist at the University of North Carolina, was speaking at an American Diabetes Association symposium where he called into question the cardiovascular safety of rosiglitazone. Both of these things in and of themselves are not bad things. Sure, the FDA in hindsight should have required more data, but their backs were against the wall, so although I do point blame on them, I don't point too much blame on them for the initial approval of the drug. And Dr. John Buse is a scientist. He's a physician. He is allowed to question medicine, if you will. He is allowed to say, hey, I think something's not right here. He's allowed to say, hey, I don't think that this is correct. But for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. For the action of the FDA approval for rosiglitazone, the reaction was a ton of prescribing of rosiglitazone. drug reps were in the office showing you how great this new drug is and how this drug does not cause liver failure and how it lowers your A1C blood test, which we have all artificially made up as the gold standard compared to any actual heart outcome. And the drug reps would talk about how rosiglitazone lowered the crap marker. Wait a second, did I just say the crap marker? Sorry, I meant they would talk about how it lowered the CRP blood marker. But given the value, the sensitivity, the relative predictive value of the CRP, I probably was right the first time. Sadly, we as physicians ate from their hands and prescribed a bunch of it, tons of it, over $3 billion worth of it. But the saying goes that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So, of course, the action of Dr. John Boos, who spoke out against rosiglitazone, certainly has to trigger a reaction from Glasgow, Smith, and Klein, the maker of rosiglitazone. And what was this reaction, you say? What was the reaction to the drug company hearing that one physician somewhere at a symposium questioned their drug? Well, they went after Dr. John Boos with a team of lawyers and per paperwork given to the United States Senate Committee on Finance, it was clear that Dr. John Boos was basically forced into signing an agreement stating that he no longer worried about the cardiovascular risk associated with rosiglitazone, and he was barred from expressing concerns about safety of the drug in the future. The company was threatening to sue him for damages from his comments, which Glasgow Smith Klein was claiming had cost them over $4 billion in lost stock options. Yes, this is 1999, and Glasgow Smith Klein is acting like the Italian mafia that we see on the movies. They don't care about the patients, they care about their $4 billion loss in stock prices. What is even more disgusting is that Glasgow Smith Klein used this forced retraction letter, this letter that they forced or basically bullied Dr. Boos into signing to gain a foothold with financial investors. They would say, oh, look at this letter. He has came out and said that he was wrong. He didn't mean what he said. Don't worry about what he said previously. We have this letter that he has signed saying that he is retracting his statement. As you can see, go ahead and invest in our company. Some of the testimony and documents that were revealed in the Senate Finance Committee will make you never want to prescribe another Glasgow Smith Klein drug ever again if you could help it. It is truly sickening some of the things that they did to try to keep everything under wraps on a drug that they knew was harming patients. So we have this drug company, Glasgow Smith Klein, that knows they have a bad drug, or at least a drug that requires further investigation and evaluation, but is doing everything they can to cover up or hide what leadership knows to be true. And I say knows to be true because in the documents and the press releases and the emails that were released, it becomes very obvious that they knew that this was true. Luckily for us, the world, patients everywhere, providers everywhere, in 2004, Glasgow Smith Klein was sued over their drug, paroxetine, also known as Paxil. And the state of New York was claiming that Glasgow Smith Klein had not released or published the results of their unfavorable or negative trials on paroxetine. And while I will get back to rosiglitazone just here shortly, let's take a quick detour to paroxetine. Now remember, the lawsuit for paroxetine was filed by the state of New York in 2004, but in 2003, paroxetine, also known as Paxil, was killing it. In fact, it is estimated that in 2003, it was a $4.9 billion drug, basically a $5 billion drug. They were taking over the market share. People were putting it in everything, even the drinking water. $5 billion in 2003, and then bam, lawsuit in 2004 saying, hey, listen, you have not released all your data, and some of this data is helpful for the medical community. Well, let's look at the data that was not released and came out once the lawsuit was finalized or during the process of the lawsuit. Glasgow Smith Klein ran two trials of paroxetine in adolescents, and I don't blame them. They're doing a great job just killing the market. You might as well be one of the only drugs that works for adolescents. You then will really kill the market. You could have been up to $10 billion, and we all know that money doesn't matter, but individuals that say that know that money is maybe the only thing that matters, or at least when it comes to the drug company. During these two studies, study 329, which was conducted between 1993 and 1996, and at the time it was the largest trial to date for the use of SSRIs in the pediatric population. In this study, paroxetine did not beat placebo. The other study, study 377, placebo was actually more effective than the antidepressant. Those are not the results that the drug company was hoping for. And instead of releasing these results to the medical community, GlaxoSmithKline decided to try to cover up the results. And how do I know this, you ask? Well, because one of the reasons that this whole lawsuit actually began was from a leaked email, an accidentally leaked email from the corporation that stated that because the results were, quote, insufficiently robust. No, they weren't insufficiently robust. They were actually terrible for what you were looking for. But because they were insufficiently robust, the company needed to, and I quote, effectively manage the dissemination of these data in order to minimize any potential negative commercial impact. What they're saying is, we need to make sure that these results don't get out there in order to minimize any potential losses to our revenue. AKA, don't let anyone know about these results. The data was hidden or covered up for years. And as I said, in 2003, paroxetine was a $4.9 billion drug. These trials ran from 93 to 96. They held this information for a really long time. Luckily for us, when GlaxoSmithKline settled the case, they wrote a check for $3 billion, and it was the biggest, largest settlement from a pharmaceutical company ever in history at that time. But you have to remember, the drug brought in almost $5 billion. So $3 billion is roughly 9 months of salary from just one drug, not from all the money that they brought in, 9 months of salary or 9 months of revenue from one drug. And in addition to the financial settlement, the drug company, GlaxoSmithKline, also agreed to make a clinical registry that has all of their clinical data after December 27th, 2000. Now you might be saying, Andrew, you keep saying luckily. You keep saying luckily. How is this luckily? How is it a good thing when a company that is bringing in deca-billions in revenue is hit with a measly $3 billion fine? Well, then if you're asking that question, you don't know how this story ends. So let's go back to rosiglitazone. The clinical registry that GlaxoSmithKline agreed to participate in, agreed to release all of their information to, was all of their clinical data. It was not just the data on paroxetine. It was also the data on rosiglitazone. And that is where the luck comes in. Now that the data was out there in the clinical registry, you, me, anyone that had access to this clinical registry could then do a study on it. And it turns out that is exactly what happened. A meta-analysis of 42 studies, 35 of which were unpublished. And you have to ask yourself, before I even get to the results, why would you not publish 35 studies on a potential drug? My guess is because they didn't show what you wanted them to show. This data was pored over and packaged into a nice little paper for publication to the all-wonderful and incredibly high-impact journal that most of you have heard of called the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, when you submit an article to the New England Journal of Medicine or to any medical journal, really, there is a peer review process that goes on. For those of you that are not in medicine, basically this is when other experts in the field that did not write the paper with you or other individuals with a certain amount of knowledge on the subject that you are writing on review the paper at hand, ask you questions, and then make sure that every T is crossed and every I is dotted. They ask you questions that you may or may not have thought of, and they help get the paper ready for its final publication inside of the journal. And when you peer review a paper, it is supposed to be secretive. You can't share this document with anyone, not even your best friend. No one is supposed to be aware of this document. Unfortunately, one of the individuals that did the peer review for this paper that was going to go in the New England Journal of Medicine Dr. Stephen Hafner at the University of Texas in San Antonio sent the analysis, sent the paper to GlaxoSmithKline. Yes, he sent the paper to the drug company. Remember, you're not supposed to even share this paper with your best friend, not a work colleague, no one. And you certainly are not supposed to share this paper with the drug company that is at question. This is a breach of professional ethics. And every journal that I'm aware of has rules when you do a peer review paper or when you peer review anything. And I can certainly guarantee you that Dr. Stephen Hafner sending this paper straight to the drug company is certainly in violation of these ethics and of these rules set place by the journal. Why would someone do this? Why would someone send the paper to the drug company? Maybe it's because Dr. Stephen Hafner was getting paid by GlaxoSmithKline. Yep, he had made almost $100,000 in total payment up to that point. This is truly a mafia-like story. The mafia we see in the movies. They cover up information. They have every good cop or good guy, quote unquote, in the city on their payroll. If you want to turn them in, if you want to go to the police department and try to get something to happen, oh wait, those police are on the payroll. It didn't matter. It seemed like every way, which way you turned, they were able to cover up their tracks. And when you have a drug that brings in over $3 billion, it likely is pretty easy to do that as long as money talks. This New England Journal of Medicine article is the same one that I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. And just like that, we've now come full circle. The article that I first mentioned at the beginning of the podcast was titled Effect of Rosiglitazone on the Risk of Myocardial Infarction and Death from Cardiovascular Causes, which was a meta-analysis that sought to find if cardiovascular morbidity and mortality were decreased by rosiglitazone. And ultimately, the results showed that those in the rosiglitazone group compared to those in the control group were 43% more likely to suffer a myocardial infarction, with a trend towards increased rates of death from cardiovascular causes. As I said at the beginning, this paper was a show stopper, a prescription stopper, if you will, for GlaxoSmithKline. And although they had this paper in their hands 2 weeks prior to publication, although they have a whole human resource and publication and media department, I'm sure, that were set out to try to mitigate the release of this paper, although they knew what was coming 2 weeks prior, once they got the publication in their hands, they did their own statistical analysis and concluded that the numbers were absolutely correct. The numbers were spot on. They were not surprised by the findings. That's right. The drug company was not surprised by the findings. And you may be saying, why were they not surprised by the findings? Well, it's because in 2006, 1 year prior, they had already done their own analysis, which found a 30 to 43% increase in ischemic events. And this data was shared with the FDA, who then did their own analysis and found a similar 40% increase in ischemic events. What's really disappointing is that neither the FDA nor GlaxoSmithKline ever announced this information or publicly released it to the medical community. Why would this happen, you ask? My guess is money, because that seems to be a trend during this whole story. However, I was not able to find this proven to be true. And at this point, you know most of the story, and we're getting towards the end of the story. As I said at the beginning, we'll start at the end with this 2007 paper, then I'll take you round circle from a drug that caused fulminant hepatitis to an FDA approval based on 5 trials in 1999, all the way through the release of this paper in 2007. So now that we're near the end, let's finish this off before this ship sets sail out into the ocean of evidence. Unfortunately, the ending to this story is both good and bad, depending on how you look at it. Eventually, 5 months after the meta-analysis that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and almost an entire year after the FDA made their own similar conclusions about rosiglitazone, they, the FDA, finally added a black box warning for increased risk of ischemic myocardial events. And remember when the drug rosiglitazone was being approved by the FDA, and in the analysis, the final analysis by the FDA, they said, and I quote, "A post-marketing study to address these issues needs to be a condition of approval." Well, it comes at no surprise that GlaxoSmithKline knew that this would be bad news for them, so no well-designed cardiovascular outcome trials were conducted. The RECORD trial was the only cardiovascular outcome trial which looked to compare cardiovascular outcomes, and it was a seriously underpowered open-label study with low adherence to medications. And it was not completed until 10 years following the FDA approval. But after there was so much publicity, the FDA did mandate that the study, the cardiovascular outcome study, be performed in 2007, which comes at no surprise after the release of internal documents and advisory committees and a meta-analysis showing a 40% increase in ischemic cardio events. There is absolutely no surprise that this trial that the FDA was forcing the drug company to perform had a very low rate or very slow rate of enrollment, because anyone who watched TV or read the newspaper knew this was a bad drug, and no provider wants to enroll a patient on a drug that is knowingly harmful. Ultimately, the trial was halted in 2010, and I think for good reason. When you are a patient going into a trial, hopefully you get a miracle cure drug, and at worst, you get a placebo. In this particular trial, at best, you would get a placebo, and at worst, you would get a harmful drug. Dr. Boos, the physician that made the initial statement of warning back in 1999 and was shut up by the drug company and had to sign the document, well, it turns out he was right all along. And at a 2007 FDA safety panel meeting on rosiglitazone, FDA scientists presented data showing rosiglitazone was estimated to have caused approximately 83,000 excess heart attacks since coming onto the market. If Dr. Boos, a scientist, a physician, a diabetes specialist, was able to speak freely and question medicine, it is almost certain some of these heart attacks would have been prevented. But with every darkness must come light, and this story is not all bad. It, at the time, did lead to a bunch of people questioning medicine, which I will forever be a fan of. I agree with Dr. John Mandrola when he says we need to promote more skeptical priors. And because of this crazy, wild mishap that was allowed to go on, in December of 2008, the FDA issued new guidance for development of drugs to treat diabetes, requiring cardiovascular outcome trials. This is the reason we now have the SGLT2 inhibitors that seem to be working to prevent cardiovascular events. The trials were not set up to try to prevent cardiovascular events in non-diabetics. The drug company didn't necessarily think that this drug was going to decrease rates of cardiovascular events. They were really just hoping not to show an increased rate of cardiovascular events. And with that, we have summed up, we have carried out, and we have went full circle. And I will end this podcast as I've ended every one before it. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.